Our next case this morning is number 064435, Deborah L. Lewis against School District 70. Mr. Lewis.
Good morning, judges. My name is Dave Lewis, and I'm here for the plaintiff appellant. And I'm here today because the lower court has granted summary judgment to the defendants on each count of her four-count complaint. She alleged violations of the FMLA, contract violation, defamation, and infliction of emotional distress.
Mr. Lewis, while our audio system is very good for recording, it's not terribly good for amplifying, so you may want to raise your voice just a little bit.
I will. Thank you. The plaintiff in this case had worked at a grade school down southern Illinois for about 6 years when her father became ill and she started missing work to take care of him. That was in August of 2003. Her mother became ill in November of 2003, and she missed work to take care of her, too. That continued until November of 2004, when the school district offered her protected leave under the FMLA. And she accepted that leave, and on March the 23rd, her boss came to her and told her that the board had no idea you were missing so much work and voted to fire you. The next day, she complained to her boss in an email asking how she could be fired for missing too much work while she was on the FMLA, protected leave. And her boss referred that email to his attorney, or the school's attorney, Defendant Jones, and Defendant Jones replied that the district had determined her performance was not satisfactory, and that's why she was losing her job. Now, of course, that reason didn't mesh with the reason that she was given just the day before. And so we became concerned, and we asked for a copy of her personnel file, and that came in about a month and contained about 7 items that could be considered problems with the bookkeeper's office, although not necessarily mistakes of the plaintiff. And not necessarily indicators of poor performance on the part of the plaintiff.
Did these occur during the time when the plaintiff was was taking intermittent family leave?
Yes, sir.
I see.
Those 7 did.
And those were performance problems that were while she was on leave.
Well, they were problems that occurred in the bookkeeper's office, not necessarily performance problems of Debbie's.
Was the plaintiff performing all of the duties of that office during that period?
She was. They never gave her a break for any reason, never assigned any of her duties to anyone else. She was responsible for the whole thing.
And got no help.
She got no help. And she was missing, I think, about 1 week.
Basically said to her, you could take intermittent family leave, but you'd better keep up with your full-time duties at the same time.
That's exactly right.
And she had a hard time doing that.
She did.
Okay.
So
am I right? Is that the essence of your case? That's your beef.
That's my beef, yes, sir. From that point on, she was sick. She had gone through quite an emotional experience in the previous year with the death of her father on May 23rd.
And let me go back because I want to now talk about the emotional distress claim because.
Yes.
She said repeatedly in emails, and I understand this outcome of being fired was not something that was kind or compassionate, but the point is in the emails she said, she had said in emails that Hawkins was gentle, compassionate, and kind. And I want to know how that kind of behavior, which is how she characterized her boss, because every time she needed it, he gave her the leave. I understand this issue of not providing any help when she was out on leave and her being fully responsible for everything. But how does that support a claim for infliction of emotional distress?
Well, apparently, while he was being so nice to her, and apparently he was being extra nice, nicer than he'd ever been, is the way she described it. And like I said, he offered her the leave on November 10th, 2004, and told her she was an asset to the district and a good employee, didn't want to lose her. And 2 weeks later, at the board meeting, he told the board that if the district's attorney, well, he said there's no doubt that she's not going to be here much longer, and if the district's attorney had told him that he could have fired her a month or 2 months ago, he'd have done that. And this was after he patted her on the back and told her she was a great employee and and had been being so nice, and apparently he was planning to take her job away that whole time, that he was being so nice to her. And that's why it came as such a shock when he did finally relieve her of her position, that she had basically been misled. She was never warned either that she had poor performance or that she was missing too much work. And like you said, he was always happy to tell her to take off work. Never a problem. And then dropped the hammer. After that, like I said, it was an emotional time. Her father passed away May 23rd. Then a sister-in-law on the day of his funeral died. Then her little brother's father-in-law passed away the next week. And then a dear friend of hers passed away on June 19th. So there's four people that died within a month's time. And then another family friend died in August. And then her father-in-law on October the 15th, 2004. And so she was. It was quite a summer. And in the meantime, her mother had come home from the hospital extremely weak, and we frankly expected her to die.
Now, this defamation claim, these statements that were made by the city's lawyer to you, and I don't understand why they're not absolutely privileged under Illinois law.
Well, absolute privilege, when there's a lawsuit pending, there was no lawsuit pending.
Well, it was made in connection with a possible lawsuit.
Well, sort of.
Right? Yeah. I mean, yeah. That was the point of the conversation, threatened lawsuit. So I guess,
well, no,
not threatened,
actually,
but anticipated.
If they never said they were anticipating a lawsuit, that was never part of their record. He made that false statement to me and to several other people, or some other people, and of course must have known that the school would tell potential future employers of Debbie as a plaintiff that's what, you know, why they fired her. And so after that happened, then in July of 2005, just a few days before her mom passed away, she sent her boss an email and asked to be reinstated. So that, you know,
how big a school district is this? Huh?
There are about almost 1,000 kids there.
How many different schools?
Actually, it is a magnet school. No, I'm sorry, the high school is a magnet school. The grade school is just serves the village of Freeburg and some outlying. You know.
Trying to get an idea as to how extensive her duties were. How many school buildings are we talking about?
Two,
a high school and an elementary school.
Yeah, and about 100 full-time or employees and a lot of subs, maybe 50 subs.
Okay.
So she was busy. It's a $6 million budget, and she did the payroll, the accounts payable, accounts receivable, insurance claims, all sorts of things, all the business that the school conducted.
Had to take care of all the withholding,
right,
reporting,
taxes,
all
right,
of that stuff.
That's correct.
And she reported directly to the superintendent.
Right, correct. And so, you know, being fired was quite a shock, and she got sick from it. She right away, she had felt like she was having a heart attack, and we took her to the doctor the next week, and her blood pressure was, I think, 180 over 120. It was very high, and she had dizzy spells, indigestion, of course, and different things, and basically an emotional wreck, and she's been treating with a psychologist ever since, and with a psychiatrist since January of this year.
Getting back to the defamation, you certainly communicated to the board's lawyer, and you signed it in your capacity as a lawyer. And this Atchison case says that those communications are protected, and even if a lawsuit was not eventually filed, I mean, you laid out your position from a legal standpoint. So
indeed I did. I asked her boss how he could do that. And, you note that I asked her boss that and not Mr. Jones. And I had conversed with her boss via that same email account, and she had conversed with her boss with that same email account that has that automatic signature applied that says it's from the law office. And so her boss knew that that was nothing unusual. That's the only email account that we ever used. And why he assumed that I was their attorney, I guess because I am attorney, I don't know, but it was an assumption and a faulty one.
Well, wasn't the sequence that he then referred you to Jones?
No, he didn't refer me. He apparently referred that.
He copied Jones, and then Jones communicated with you.
Yes, ma'am.
And then the defamation you're concerned with is saying that her performance as a bookkeeper was not satisfactory, that the lawyer said.
Well, that he said that the board determined her performance,
right,
and
that
never happened. It's the board is a unit of local government, and they have requirements about making their record. You know, the statute tells them what's supposed to be in there, and there is absolutely nothing in their official record, either closed session minutes or open session minutes, that says they were ever concerned about her performance. And in fact, her boss told them in November 2004, just 2 weeks after he put her on or offered her that FMLA leave, they were discussing the potential liability if they had have just fired her. And he said, no, I think our liability would be more than 10 weeks. He says it was her job. She could point to 6, 7, 8, 9 years of no problems with her performance, and that would be true. That was her boss talking just months before he fired her for missing work. And
you're
of course,
in your rebuttal time.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, it's okay.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you. We'll hear now from Mr. Hardy.
Good morning, Your Honors. William Hardy for the school district defendants. And we have reserved 3 minutes for Mr. Peroni on the defamation issues. Your Honors, in our brief, we outlined in some detail with proper citations to the record the overwhelming evidence of performance problems in this case. Plaintiff got up here today before you and made his arguments based on what he perceives the record to be.
Well, didn't Hawkins' letter demoting Lewis give only one reason for the decision? She was missing too much work to be effective. And since most of her absences, the missing of work in late 04 and early 05 was when she was on FMLA leave, why isn't that direct evidence of retaliation?
Well, perhaps the letter could have been worded a little bit better, but it's certainly related to performance. And the next letter from Mr. Jones certainly indicated that there were performance problems.
Right, but that in itself, the fact that there was the next letter, didn't that create a factual issue for the jury? Even if we give you that, because I still think that first letter where the only reason she was let go was missing too much work and the only time she was missing work was because of FMLA is a big problem for you.
Well, the letter, as I say, perhaps it could have been worded differently, but there's no question that her performance was lacking. Even in the board minutes, even in the board meetings that
Mr. Hardy, my difficulty with that argument is that it doesn't seem to address the cause for any lapses in her performance. It seems to me that what paragraph 17 of the complaint, the plaintiff is alleging, is that you put her in a catch-22 situation. You said, yeah, you can take FMLA leave, and you can take it on an intermittent basis, but we're going to hold you to the performance of a full-time employee in this job. All right? You gave her no slack for the fact that she was permitted to take the FMLA leave during that period. And so I don't understand why you did not impermissibly burden this employee in the exercise of her FMLA rights.
Well, Your Honor, first of all, I don't think it's accurate that we didn't provide her with any help. There's ample evidence in the record that Dr. Hawkins pitched in, that other people pitched in, and repeatedly assisted the plaintiff. The plaintiff doesn't want to rely on any of that evidence. Secondly, there's nothing in the Act or in the regulations that requires us to hire someone else. She agreed to do intermittent leave, and she thought she could do her job based on that. But the problems, as the district court noted...
Well, if I may, she wasn't given much of a choice. Well, she was told she was either going to do that or she was going to be fired.
No, she was not told that. In November, she chose intermittent leave. She could have taken 12 weeks leave or she could have taken intermittent leave. They agreed to give her intermittent leave at that point. The choice that she was given was in March of 2004 or of 2005, after they had these repeated performance problems, which we outlined in detail in our brief, where she was given the choice to be reassigned to a teacher's aide position at the same rate of pay and with the same benefits until the end of the fiscal year. She did, in fact, continue to work until the end of the fiscal year. After she was reassigned, they discovered even more problems, which were outlined in a letter to her when she sought reinstatement. Those problems, and I don't want to go through them in too much detail, but they were serious performance problems relating to bills that weren't paid, unopened mail.
Was she actually given a choice of taking 12 weeks of leave rather than intermittent leave?
I don't know if the record reflects that. I think in one of the board meetings, which we think plaintiff is totally misrepresented, which I'll get to in a minute, but it was discussed with her, and she selected intermittent leave. I think they would have been more than willing to give her 12 weeks leave if she wanted that. But the point is that...
Yeah, but there's nothing in the record that says she was offered the 12 weeks. What's in the record?
He's not alleging, or nor has he ever alleged, that we improperly failed to give her 12 weeks of leave. I think the record's pretty clear that she didn't want intermittent leave for 12 weeks. But there's nothing that precludes us from reassigning her to another position if she's on intermittent leave. The regulations say that.
Didn't do it, though.
We did reassign her to a different position.
Afterwards you did. But after the problems arose. But the problems arose, she was taking her intermittent leave and performing full duty. Am I right?
Well, the problems arose. Actually, the problems started long before that, and they're discussed with the board throughout. But they particularly got bad, there's no question about it, in January, February, and March. And as the district court noted, these aren't problems that are related solely to her not being there.
Well, I mean, now, prior to, though, her being on FMLA leave, these problems you said she had, was there paper in the record indicating she had problems?
Yes.
In her evaluations?
Well, the record indicates that no evaluations were done, and there was no requirement that evaluations be done for these types of employees.
And no letter had been given to her about her poor performance prior to her taking FMLA leave or being problems, right?
There was an evaluation, and a letter was given to her eventually. But
I'm talking about pre-FMLA, because what you said was these were problems that were continued through the FMLA leave time. So I want to know, where's the documentation in the record that supports that?
Well, attached to our motion for summary judgment, we attached emails, we attached all kinds of documents.
Pre-FMLA.
Pre-FMLA. Now, the plaintiff is arguing now that that's somehow a violation of FMLA, and he cites the one sentence one paragraph of the complaint. That was never an issue in this case. The complaint alleges that on November 9th, we gave her the option. She took intermittent FMLA leave. She then worked intermittent FMLA leave, and then he calls it a termination. We think it's a reassignment. She, in fact, was reassigned. Occurred then in March. There's never been any allegation that we violated the FMLA prior to that date. In fact,
well, I understand that, but you said in your argument that these problems she had while on FMLA leave were problems that had been in existence prior to that time. And I asked the question, what documentation? And so you're telling me there are emails back and forth before anybody gets sick, before anybody dies or anything, about her poor performance.
There's emails, there are documents relating to unpaid bills, there are documents...
Prior to the FMLA.
Prior to the FMLA leave, yes, and we outlined those in some detail in our brief. And and I'd like to talk just a little bit about this period between December, January, February, March of 2004, leading up to this time. Your Honors, these are very serious problems. They're getting notices from... indicating that there's going to be a $163,000 penalty. We've got emails going back and forth between the plaintiff and Dr. Hawkins where, for example, let me just give you an example, and these are all in the brief. The W-2 forms. Dr. Hawkins sends an email to the plaintiff on January 27th saying, look, we're getting inquiries from the teachers about the W-2 forms. When are they going to go out? She sends an email back same day, says, they're ready right now. They're done. You know, that doesn't relate to her not being there. She says they're done. Okay? Then later on in an email, she says, well, I put it up right up to the deadline on January 31st. Then it's discovered a teacher comes in and complains to Dr. Hawkins that, hey, I didn't receive it until long after, and here it is. It's postmarked after the 31st. Now, these don't relate to her not being there. These are things she said she would do that she didn't do. And they discover all kinds of things that, you know, I just don't know how you can conclude that these are not related to performance. You know, the other thing
right,
I want...
The only question is, we're here on summary judgment. And so in the initial letter, there's no mention of performance. I mean, right, in that initial letter. The performance comes in the second letter.
The initial letter does... It says that she... you're right. It says that she's not meeting her essential functions of her present assignment. And it's true that the next day... that's when the letter comes out that's talking about performance. But we've got emails going back and forth, and we have all kinds of documents during that period of time showing very serious problems. And the notion that the board didn't consider those things is simply not supported by the record. Herschel Parrish, the president, said, look, these were problems. We had teachers coming, complaining to us. We had fines that were going to be assessed. We were concerned that the job wasn't being done. At that point, they reassigned her to another position. There's nothing wrong with that. Now, what they did later on is they created, they abolished that position at the end of the fiscal year, and they created a new position which included many other duties. Now, plaintiff was not reappointed to that position, but there's nothing that violates the FMLA, particularly when you consider that afterwards they went through the plaintiff's messy office and there's all these problems that are you know, just problem after problem after problem that further reinforces the performance problems that existed previously.
I just want to make sure I have the language of that first letter correct. It says it was determined that you missed too much work to meet the essential functions of your present assignment, end quote. You missed too much work. That's what the first letter said.
That's what the letter says, Your Honor.
Okay.
As I say, perhaps that should have been worded better. But the evidence in the record, including the personnel file and what the plaintiff was notified about afterwards, very clearly indicates that there were very significant performance problems here. Now, the other point I want to make, and plaintiff kind of just disregards this in the briefs, is we've got a situation where the plaintiff has sent emails. Dr. Hawkins is seeing emails in October and January saying that the plaintiff is looking for another job. I mean, and he discussed this with the board. There's an email in late October which says, this seems like a sign to me. I think I have a half a minute. I did it 11 and a half minutes. If not with our banker friend, then otherwise, then elsewhere. But my mind is made up. If things don't pan out with that organization, talking about where she's applying for a job, then we'll both be looking, I guess. We need to talk about how soon I should arrange things here, which I think should be very soon. Then in January, she sends an email to her husband saying, I think I'll give notice around Easter break, so get your ducks in a row. So we're not just talking about performance. We're talking about them being concerned that she's going to quit her job, and at the same time, her performance is lacking. And that's discussed with the board, too. And in conclusion, Your Honor, I know I'm out of time. I would just ask the court to very carefully look at the cites to the record in this case. They do not support a lot of the arguments that the plaintiff is making. He cites to his own memoranda rather than competent evidence. And if
sure you, we look at the cites very carefully.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear now from Mr. Barone.
Thank you, Your Honor. John Barone on behalf of Appellee Shane Jones, who, as you know, was outside counsel to the school district. As Judge Williams pointed out, the Atkinson case controls the defamation law in this area. And that case specifically holds that there is an absolute privilege for statements made by an attorney to publish defamatory matter concerning another in any kind of proceeding preliminary to a proposed judicial proceeding. the fact that the lawsuit was threatened here and that a lawsuit ensued and that we're here today is definitely evidence of that. Judge Steele found that the record supported the truth of the statement that Mr. Jones made in his letter to Mrs. Lewis's attorney. Mr. Lewis today admitted that there were performance problems that Mrs. Lewis was suffering, and Judge Steele found that Mrs. Lewis, in fact, admitted to various performance problems in her affidavit in opposition to Mr. Jones's motion for summary judgment. Mr. Lewis and Mrs. Lewis have tried to change the theory of their case, arguing today and in their appellate briefing and in their motion for reconsideration that the board did not make a determination regarding Mrs. Lewis's performance. That was never brought up in the complaint, and that was never adjudicated below and is improper at this point in time. Furthermore, Mr. Lewis takes issue with the Judge Steele's motion to deny the motion for reconsideration. That was discretionary on the part of Judge Steele. Judge Steele correctly found, even after looking at the new evidence, that in fact the record was replete with performance problems that the board had found in Mrs. Lewis's performance as the bookkeeper, and that there was no new evidence to support a motion for the lower court to reconsider. Finally, Mrs. Lewis takes issue with whether or not the lower court properly exercised their discretion in not granting Mrs. Lewis's motions to strike late answers. In fact, both the magistrate judge and the district judge found that those pleadings were filed on time, reading the federal rules of civil procedure in accordance with the local rules, and we would argue that they properly exercised their discretion. That's all I have, unless there's any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Baroni. How much time does Mr. Lewis have? Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
First, I would address Mr. Hardy's assertion there were repeated instances of help by her boss and her coworkers, and there's no record of any help from her boss or her coworkers except for two instances. One, the day after her father died, her boss agreed to, or actually volunteered to, prepare a list of bills for the board meeting. And then in October, the plaintiff called in to school and had her boss's secretary boot her computer and print out a report. Those are the two instances of the repeated help that they refer to.
He says that she was reassigned as allowed by the FMLA, but that's not true either. The FMLA allows a temporary reassignment, and then you get to come back to your job. This was a permanent reassignment, and there was no provision for her to come back to her job at all.
When the plaintiff took her intermittent leave, was she given the option of taking 12 straight weeks of leave?
Not that I know of.
The record, in other words, silent.
Silent, right. He said, Mr. Hardy says that the problem started much earlier. And, in fact, her boss says now in his deposition that he believed her performance started suffering when she started missing so much work to care for her father, which is a qualifying reason to go on FMLA. But they never offered her FMLA for another 14 months. And I asked her boss why, and he didn't know when he was supposed to inquire. He says he relies on voice of counsel for those things. So apparently they just were ignorant of the law, and that's why they didn't offer it to her before. And that can in itself be considered a hindering of her right to take FMLA leave by just ignoring their duties. They didn't ever provide her any notice, a poster or in the employee handbook, nothing. No notice whatsoever. And her boss testified that he thought it was logical to conclude that the problems were caused by her missing work, in direct contradiction to what the lower court determined in its order. The lower court stated that none of these problems were a result of absenteeism. Her boss says they were, and not only in his deposition, but on her performance review that he gave her in March, just 2 weeks before he fired her, stated that all these problems are a result of your reduced work schedule. The $160,000 penalty from the IRS was from some W-2s that were lost from 2001, some 3 years previous, 4 years previous, were not a factor in any of this. Her boss and the board were well advised since July when this problem arose and the plaintiff was taking care of it. He said it was eventually resolved with a fine of maybe $600. So that wasn't nearly as big a deal as they're trying to make it out. The W-2, this was one of them, was late out of 150. She put them in the mail at work as per usual, and from then on, she can't she's not really responsible for what happens after when something goes in the mail. One was a day late. He said it was many days late. It was one day late. February the 1st, it was postmarked. The things that Herschel says after they got in trouble should be given less weight than what he didn't say before she complained that she'd been fired for FMLA. The record is silent as to any problems. There's nothing in their official record. She did say she wanted to quit work, and I can't blame her. She was doing two jobs, one taking care of her mother. She couldn't quit that one. She did dream of stopping work, but it was we needed money and we needed insurance, and there was no way that she could quit her job, and she knew it. The time in January that he speaks of that she said, get your ducks in a row because I'm give my notice around Easter. She'd been in, had a hard day, basically. That $163,000 penalty had arrived in the mail. Some lady yelled at her in her office. She was having a hard day. And she wrote that, get your ducks in a row, I'm going to give my notice, and pet the dog on the head, which I think was part of it. It wasn't serious. And he knew it. He was spying on her emails the whole time and never spoke to her. Thank you. I'm done. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Lewis. Our thanks to both counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement.